Our second case this morning is 2020-197, Sintera Limited versus Allen T. Winland et al. For the cross-appellant, Mr. Onest.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Matthew Onest, and I represent the cross-appellant in this case, Sintera Limited. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. We are asking your honors to answer the proposition in this cross appeal in the affirmative and thereby reinstate the trial court's decision on this issue. Although it has a unique name, the Duhigg rule is how it's referred to due to the Texas Supreme Court case that created it, it's not all that complicated. It's based on just kind of basic deed interpretation principles and general warranties of title in general warranty deeds. What it stands for is that a grantor can only reserve what he or she owns. It also takes it a step further that when a grantor cannot convey an interest and then reserve the same interest back, the grant must prevail over any sort of reservation. Once the grantor conveys his or her interest in the property to the grantee has that expectation under a general warranty of title that he or she will own it to the exclusion of the grantor. So when a deed is executed, we have to look at, referred to three quanta of interest. There's just three things we look at. What does the granting clause say? So with a warranty deed, unless it specifically states that it's granting less than the full estate, whatever it may be, minerals, property, whatever, it's presumed under a general warranty deed that 100% is going to the grantee. Then you look at the reserving clause, if any, and that tells us, okay, what is the grantor trying to pull back out of there? You subtract those two numbers, and that is what the grantee under a warranty of title deed is expecting to get from the grantor. Here's where Duhigg comes in. If the grantor cannot satisfy the grant, meaning what's left over after the reservation and the new reservation, the grant prevails and the reservation fails. That is all that rule says. And where the seventh, and so we cite, before I go to the seventh, the Supreme Court of Arkansas in the Peterson case, this is cited in the briefs, they summed it up nice and they say, you know, courts don't have to adopt Duhigg to get to the right conclusion. It's not some magical rule that if you don't adopt it, one party wins, and if you don't adopt it, the other party wins. No, it's just, okay, what did the grantor warrant that he or she was granting? What did he or she try to pull back out of that? And did he have enough or she have enough to satisfy the grant first? If you can't satisfy the grant first, in face of the new reservation you're trying to do, the grantee prevails. And so where the seventh, I think, got this wrong is they said, well, listen, Duhigg is merely a rule of equity, that we're going to apply equity across the board whenever this type of over-conveyance problem exists. Well, that's not true. Duhigg, in the first instance, is a legal question because we're talking about deed interpretation, and deed interpretation is always a legal question at the outset. Where you get into anything other than legal questions is if you have ambiguity or whatnot that you have to resort outside the four corners. The equitable portion of Duhigg, though, is the basis for where we put the risk of loss on an over-conveyance. Equity holds that the grantor is in the best position to protect him or herself against a breach of warranty of title. They limit it in the deed. The granting clause can limit it. They can reference prior interest in title to make clear to the grantee, you are not getting this percentage. So for instance, in this, and here's where we get into this case. There are five mineral reservations. This is a mineral reservation case. There are five mineral reservations in this case. There's only one at issue in this cross appeal. It's what we refer to generally as the fifth or oil and gas reservation number five. Oil and gas reservation number five was involved in a 1954 warranty deed. George Russell attempted to reserve a quarter interest in the mineral rights. But how the deed was set up is to say, I'm giving you a general warranty deed, and I'm conveying you all right title and interest, and I'm reserving a quarter. How you interpret that deed is to say, okay, he is generally warranting that I'm conveying 3/4 of an interest to my grantee, and I'm reserving 1/4. So that's what the grantee's expectation would be. I'm getting 3/4 because you are giving me a full warranty deed, all right title interest, and trying to pull out and reserve 1/4. The issue, though, is he did not own 3/4. He only owned 3/8 of the mineral rights at that time. So he could not both fulfill the grant of granting 3/4 and then reserve 1/4. So how this should have worked under Duhigg and its principles and the other courts that apply the same rule is, if the grant and the reservation cannot both begin given legal effect at the same time, which is this case here, everyone concedes at the time that George Russell did this 1954 deed, his reservation was not valid because he could not do what he wanted to do. If you cannot give the grant and the reservation legal effect at the exact same time with that deed, you have a breach of warranty of title. And what happens when you have a breach of warranty of title? The law is pretty clear on that. And even the Seventh was clear in its prior decision in Talbot. If it cannot both be given effect when that deed's executed, the grantee is the party who should benefit from that. They are in the best position to protect themselves against a breach. Now, where the Seventh went even further is they said, well, okay, we concede that part. In 1954, George Russell was in breach of his warranty of title. So the grantee should get 3/8, he had a 3/8 interest left over. He should get 3/8. But we're going to say then, but the surface owners, decades later, could prevail on getting rid of prior reservations to their benefit on their claims. And somehow then, 50, 60 years later, that can go back in time and validate what occurred in 1954. The issue with that is, one, we look at the deed itself. We're confined to what the deed says, and obviously it's chain and calculating what he owns. And no one can argue that at the time he did this deed, he could not do this. So no one can argue that he was not in breach. The marketable title stuff was where the Seventh kind of goes off on a tangent, and it has no impact on it in this case because, one, the mineral owners made no claim, made no defense about marketable title. There's no evidence of George Russell's root of title. So that's the key part. Your honors have been inundated with marketable title cases over the last 5, 6, 7 years, so you're very familiar with this. The starting point with a marketable title analysis is always the same. Find that root deed, that root of title, that 40-year-old instrument. There's no evidence, there's nothing in the record of George Russell's root. All the parties were looking at Sentara's root to all these different reservations. That is a different root, different chain of title than George Russell may have. George Russell was never in the previous chains of title for the first two interests we're talking about. Those were separate parties who reserved it before he got involved. They're separate, legally distinct interests. So the important thing here is we all are in agreement, I guess, when I say we, the Seventh, at the lower court, the cross appellee was in agreement on the first threshold issue. Is there a breach of warranty of title because he tried to overconvey and with the reservation? Yes, we're there. The second question then becomes, okay, now what do we do? Our position, based upon Duhigg and the analysis and all these other cases, is the reservation's void. And it's void as of the date of the reservation, the deed. Subsequent events cannot go back in time, reverse the flow of time, and reborn that invalid void ab initio reservation. To do that sacrifices certainty, 4 corners of a document, and the recording statute for these ad hoc reviews where 50, 60, 70, 100 years later, we're saying, well, what happened then to go back in time? It destroys the concept of deed interpretation, which is the heart of that. We have to rely on the documents. And it ignores the fact that items in the law, when they're void ab initio, are just that. They're not voidable, they're void. This reservation was void ab initio and of no legal effect. And it also ignores the equity that the Seventh referenced. The Seventh said, well, it's an equitable rule. Okay, let's presume for a moment that the 7th District is right and it's an equitable rule. Well, Duhigg addressed this very issue, and it said that the breaching grantor should be the party in equity, in fairness, to bear the risk of loss, because they have the ability to avoid the breach.
Okay, let's assume we agree with you that it was void in 1954. So where does that leave this case? What do we need to do?
So what you would do if you answer proposition law in the affirmative is you would reverse the 7th District's decision as to Oil and Gas Reservation 5 and reinstate the trial court's decision. The trial court found that it was a void reservation under Duhigg and it was no longer effect.
Do we need to remand to the trial court, or would we just enter judgment here? Is there anything left for the trial court to do?
There are 5 reservations. As to the first 4 reservations, there's nothing more to do. The only issue we have here is as to number 5. You reverse the 7th District, and you would reverse that. There is no more proceedings to be necessary in the trial court. The trial court has already done the analysis to say, under Duhigg, I find that the Oil and Gas Reservation 5 is void and it's no longer effective. So that's all we would need you to do. Answer in the affirmative, reinstate the trial court's decision as to number 5.
Do we limit this only to situations involving the Dormant Mineral Act, or is this going to end up applying to a residential area where there's a sidewalk between two properties and they kind of, over time, that line blurs on who it belongs to?
Absolutely. This is not a dormant mineral issue, and this is where I was concerned, because the 7th District went off on the marketable tangent, or marketable title tangent. This is a generally applicable rule for general warranty deeds only. It really, in my experience, is coming up mostly in all of these mineral issue cases, because that's where you run into this fraction issue where people are trying to reserve a half here and a quarter here. In most cases, you're not running into where multiple people are carving out fractional portions of interest. So is it limited to mineral interests? Absolutely not. It's limited to general warranty deeds and whether or not the grant and a reservation can be given effect. In practicality, do I believe it's going to be limited in future cases or in future application to fractional mineral reservations? I tend to think yes, because that's where we're seeing fractional interests in property.
But it could apply to easements, though, correct?
Only if you have this fractional issue where someone cannot is saying, I'm going to convey you a certain percentage of interest, and I'm going to reserve another percentage, and I can't do both. With an easement, you either convey it, or it travels with the conveyed property, or you're reserving it unto yourself. I can't think of a scenario where we would have to get into an over conveyance issue with an easement.
Well, what if it's conveyed without any mention of the easement?
So then, at that point in time, what we're getting on there is issues of easement law. So, for instance, if it's an express easement, and it's in chain, it's recorded, it's valid, and all that, then it would travel with the land. The grantee's burdened by a recorded easement. You take notice of all these recorded documents.
But you're basically saying if you over convey, then it's void ab initio, and then it essentially the error falls on the grantor, and the grantee basically benefits.
Correct, for here. But in your scenario, you wouldn't be over conveying. You would be conveying the land subject to things that are of record. The grantee then would take subject to that easement, assuming it's of record. There are other types of easements that you can be bound by. You wouldn't have an over conveyance problem. You would have an issue of, okay, did you disclose the easement? Is it of record? If it's of record, the grantee has no issue. This is specifically only saying, you told me you were going to give me an undivided 100% interest. You said you were going to reserve some percentage back, but you didn't have, so easy one. I convey to you 100% of the property. I reserve 50%. What if I only own 25% at the time? I can't give you 50% and reserve 50. Those don't work together. So what happens is that 25% I do actually own in the interest would have to pass to you, because I'm in breach of my warranty of title telling you I'm going to give you 100% minus 50. I'm going to give you 50%. I can't do that. So that's why I think with the easement, it's going to be different because you're not going to have these fractional interests in
but
property.
Aren't those fractional interests recorded?
Correct. No. Because
you're kind of saying that if I'm going to transfer land and not talk about an easement, because it's in the record and when the title company does its search, it's going to show up. So what's the difference if it's recorded when it's a reservation of the mineral rights?
So the difference being is at the time you and I enter into that deed, that warranty deed, and I convey it, those prior interests are their own separate unique estates. They're recorded, let's say they burden the land.
They don't show up in a title search?
But they could, and that's fine. But when I enter into a general warranty deed with you and I don't tell you that, I say I'm conveying you an undivided or 100% of all right, title, and interest, and I'm reserving 50%. In a general warranty deed, what that tells us is that you have an expectation of as the grantee that you're going to get 50% interest because I'm giving you 100 minus 50.
But the title documents don't show that, correct? So nobody talks about it?
Well, the prior interests, if they're recorded, would show it, and I, as the grantor, am in the position to make sure that I don't breach my warranty. I'm giving you the warranty. I'm the one who bears the risk of loss, and that's rightfully so, because I can make it clear to you in that deed that, hey, I'm giving you all right title interest. I'm subject to prior reservations. I'm reserving the remaining 50%. If the deed said that, you would likely have no issue because it's made clear I'm not in breach of my warranty based upon the four corners of the document. But here we don't have that. We have someone who's clearly saying I'm giving you 75% of the mineral rights when I only own 3/8. They didn't disclose that. That's where you have a breach of warranty of title. So that,
Counsel,
that's the
you've
distinction.
Used your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Kimball?
Chief Justice O'Connor, Justices, may it please the court, my name is Catherine Kimball, and I'm here on behalf of the Cross Appellees this morning, who are the mineral heirs, or in the briefs, they're noted as the Windland parties. And I would like to start by saying how much I appreciate the opportunity and honor to argue before you this morning. As you have just heard by my opponent, the only remaining proposition of law in this case is regarding the Duhigg rule. And my opponent in his briefs argue that the adoption of this rule would, and the adoption of their proposition of law, would create clarity and certainty in title analyses in the state, when actually it would create more uncertainty because the facts of this case are complicated.
How so? How would it create more uncertainty?
Sure.
Because you're saying it would have to be applied on a case-by-case basis and the facts specifically won't necessarily fit into the rule?
Yes, Your Honor. So because it's dependent on the chain of title. And so in this case, as we've just heard, the reservation in question right now is this 1954 reservation of a quarter mineral interest. And prior to that reservation in the chain of title, there are two other reservations that affect this parcel. And so because these cases and applying that rule are dependent on the entire chain of title, not the one reservation in a vacuum, that's difficult.
But isn't that a common case? Isn't that a common scenario where there are multiple owners, surface title, mineral rights, reservation of rights, divided up between different heirs? Isn't that often the case?
Yes. In my experience, it's unusual to do a mineral title search and not find several severances, including reservations or exceptions or out sales or whatever that looks like. It's not unusual to find these types of severances. So in this situation, and applying the rule as proposed, looking at that 1954 reservation only in a vacuum doesn't work. So that's part, mostly because the root of the question at that point is, what did that grantor own? And you can't know that without looking at the prior reservations.
But you have to know what the grantor owned to know what he had in 1954, right? I mean, you can't just ignore, I mean, the fact that he said he reserved something that he didn't have.
Yes. Based on the four corners of that deed in 1954, you may not know what that grantor owned because it's dependent on the prior chain of title.
Right. But, I mean, that's why you have to look at the chain of title. I mean, if you have a four corners of a deed that someone pretends to convey something they don't own, they still can't convey it, right? And you don't just look at the deed. You look at what they owned.
Yes, Your Honor. So in this situation, and based on our facts that we have here and what the Seventh District said, we have to also consider the Marketable Title Act and how that treats mineral reservations or other.
And I guess that's where I get confused. I mean, in 1954, someone owned these rights, right? I mean, the Marketable Title Act can't fly backwards and change what someone owned in 1954, could they?
Not in 1954. No, I agree with you on that.
But that's really what you're asking. Is you're saying that, well, because you know the Marketable Title Act can allow you to move backwards in time and extinguish these reservations, will act like they didn't own what they owned in 1954. That's essentially what you have to do to get your result.
So, and I think that comes down to that we're determining now in 2018 when this case was filed, or today, what the parties own today. And I think that the interaction, and I think this is what the Seventh District was saying, that the interplay between the Marketable Title Act and a rule like Duhigg comes down to an equitable outcome. As we look today at this chain of title and these mineral reservations, this oil and gas reservation number 5 is the only one still at issue. And in that reservation, George Russell reserved a 1/4 interest in the parcel. No one has disputed that based on the prior reservations, he probably owned a 3/8 interest. But today, as we're assessing this, the Marketable Title Act has extinguished the prior reservations. And that, I mean, is not disputed, especially after your decision in West. And so it comes down to a question of equity, I think, where today, and as we've heard this morning from my opponent, that 1954 deed, he reserved a 1/4 interest. And if it looks like he was meant to convey a 3/4 interest, that is the interest that the cross appellant claims and owns today as we stand here. So the interest that they believe violated the warranty in that deed in 1954 is the interest that they own now.
That doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, what violated the warranty was saying that they reserve something that they couldn't possibly reserve because they had made a promise to convey more than they owned.
Well, yes, I mean, I understand that. I think if we're talking about a violation of warranty only in that single issue, that indeed throughout the state, that I think would be at issue, minerals or otherwise, I think at this point.
Well, I guess, I mean, maybe, but I mean, if someone can't reserve something that they don't have, so.
And I think that that's a portion of the Duhigg rule that we briefed also, is that George Russell didn't reserve more than he owned. If he owned a 3/8 interest, he only reserved a 1/4 of that. So he didn't over reserve. He reserved less than he owned.
Well, not less than he owned and promised to convey.
Sure. So it's both of those moving pieces. Yes.
You're saying he reserved one quarter of the 3/8 that he had, correct?
I believe he reserved a quarter of the whole, and he owned 3/8.
How could he do that?
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's the root of the question regarding the breach of warranty issue. I think it comes down to when we're assessing who owns what. The Duhigg rule talks about the over-reservation and over-conveyance issue and a violation of warranty there. Today, as we're talking about who owns mineral interests, we have to think about the Marketable Title Act. And so throughout this case, the issues have been intertwined. In my opponent's brief, they mentioned that affirming the Seventh District's decision would lead to this two-step litigation process where they could have sought to assume the reservation number 5 with the Duhigg rule first, and if they'd been successful on that issue, then they could have gone to extinguish the prior interests so that they could have checked off all their boxes in a two-step process. I don't think that affirming the Seventh District's decision would do that because the chain of title has to be looked at as a whole as of today. And so those prior reservations today, when we're determining who owns what interests, are extinguished. It is only this Royal and Gas Reservation number 5 that's at issue, where George Russell reserved a quarter, and today Centerra owns 3/4. And so that's the equitable outcome. In general, this case is probably not the case to create a bright line rule based on Duhigg because of the prior reservations in the chain of title and this reservation being the potential Duhigg rule issue reservation being the only one that remains. The facts here are not a good fit to do that. He didn't reserve more than he owned in 1954. The Marketable Title Act has extinguished all of those other reservations. And so when we're looking at the chain of title as a whole, we can't put the cart before the horse. We can't say, first, we need to look at the 1954 reservation and ignoring the rest of the...
Why wouldn't you look at the 1954 reservation? I mean, why wouldn't you figure out who owned what before you started using the Marketable Title Act to get rid of interest?
I think because to look
isn't
at
isn't that the natural question? Okay, who owns this? Now, once we figure out who owns it, then we can apply the Marketable Title Act and see if any interests are extinguished.
I think the difficulty with that is the Marketable Title Act also changes with time, where that root of title is, when the 40-year period has run. Because when we're looking at that now, we need to start at patent or at the first reservation to decide what someone owns at any given deed in the chain of title. Starting in the middle is...
Well, no, I mean, why wouldn't you just say, okay, how was this property conveyed? If we're going to apply the Marketable Title Act, then which interests are extinguished under the Marketable Title Act? It seems like a pretty easy two-step process. Whereas if you do it the other way, it seems hopelessly confusing. There's kind of just like one of these space-time continuum problems.
Yes, we believe that you start earlier in the chain of title and work your way through time, determining who owned what in the chain of title. Going through choosing a reservation and applying the Duhigg rule first changes conveyances following that deed, where someone may have, it could change what a quarter reservation means.
But that's just you can't give away something that you don't have, right?
The crux is when George transferred 3/4 of the land and 3/4 of the mineral rights to Centerra, he really and reserved a quarter of the mineral rights to himself. He really only had 3/8 interest in the mineral rights, And so you're basically saying that he still owned the 3/8, and that's the way that it existed in 1954, even though his deed says he was reserving a quarter, he could only reserve 3/8 because that's all he had. And you're saying he should still hold on to that 3/8 regardless, even under the Marketable Title Act, you're saying that that justifies that? And can you explain how?
I think that, so in 1954, if George Russell owned a 3/8 interest and he reserved a quarter, he didn't reserve quite all of the interest that he owned. He reserved less than he owned when we're looking at those fractional interests. And so—
Are we talking mineral rights or land?
Mineral rights.
Okay.
And he conveyed the surface in that deed.
So you're saying he conveyed only 1/8. Mm-hmm. Is that your argument?
No, it is.
Because you say he's keeping a quarter, that's 2/8, right? And he's conveying. So where's the 1/8?
Yes. He kept a quarter. So everything above the quarter.
I hear what you're saying. I'm trying to understand it.
Yes.
So what happened to the 1/8?
It went with the deed to the surface owners, I think.
So all they had is 1/8?
I think based on that.
Even though they claimed to have 3/4.
Well, that grantee in that deed is the cross appellant's predecessor in interest.
Right.
I think by about 6 deeds. And so it's been a while that interest would have passed through that chain of title. So if we look at the 1954 deed in a vacuum, which I think is not possible because we have to know if there were earlier reservations or what he owned at the time, we have to know earlier in the chain of title than just that single deed. And so that's a difficulty with the proposition of law that's proposed, is applying that rule in the middle of the chain of title without considering the prior reservations. The Marketable Title Act comes in because today, actually I think in 1992 and 2011, those prior reservations were extinguished by the Marketable Title Act. And so they are no longer an issue.
The 1/8 or the 3/4?
It's not quite a 3/4. It's the
right.
First two reservations.
Right.
So it's a 1/4 reservation and a half.
Right.
Which
1/4 plus a half would be
or a
3/4.
Yes.
That's what I was getting to.
This helps you get better at math with all these fractions. So yes, I think those prior reservations are vital to determining what someone owns in a given deed, and the Marketable Title Act has extinguished them here.
But he only had 1/8. Left.
Yes.
So when was the 8th?
When 8th conveyed.
Yeah, when was the 8th extinguished?
I don't know that it has. It went with the surface property.
Okay.
So we would ask that you affirm the 7th District's decision and decline adopting the cross appellant's proposition of law.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counselor, you, excuse me, you've used your time. You may take a minute.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. It's a pretty simple, straightforward issue. You look up until the deed at issue, determine who owns what. If the warranty deed's grant and reservation cannot be both be given effect, the grant prevails over the reservation. Here, George Russell warranted to convey 3/4 of the minerals and reserve 1/4 of the minerals. He only owned 3/8, so he cannot both convey 3/4 of the minerals and reserve 1/4 of the minerals. So the 3/8 would have to pass with the 3/4. And the only other thing I would mention is the Seventh District's decision, along with cross-appellee's arguments, was never that it was 1/4 of 3/8. It was always that they thought they owned a quarter. So there was not a double, we weren't fractionating out the 3/8, and there was no discussion of 1/8 passing forward. Their position has always been, we have a quarter reservation based upon subsequent marketable title events. We don't believe that's the case, and we would ask that you answer the proposition in the affirmative and reinstate the trial court's decision as to this specific reservation. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you're notified of our decision.